ladies and gentlemen, your favorite doctor now joins us. Everybody loves when Dr. Carroll is here because he's always happy to take your phone calls. And always good about them. The phone number, by the way, 866-994-6343. Our guest is an expert on health policy. He's also an MD, a pediatrician. He's an author. Don't Swallow Your Gum and Don't Cross Your Eyes, which are myths, half-truths, and outright lies about your body and your health. He blogs. He's a blogger, one of the most popular health policy blogs, Incidental Economist. And now he's a big YouTube star as well. As he hosts Healthcare Triage on YouTube. It's very popular. Did I tweet it out yet? I know I set it to tweet. Either way, the latest one is on antibiotics. I should probably just play the entire thing for you, or you should just go there and watch it. But we're not going to do that because we've got Dr. Carroll here. He takes phone calls. He is a taker of phone calls. So please, by all means, give us a call. Join the conversation. And 866-994-6343. Again, on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Two R's, two L's. As of now, 9,561 followers. Melanie, let's keep a good count on that. And hopefully we'll get him quite a few new ones. That's how we pay him in Twitter followers. Hello, good day to you, sir.
Good day to you.
You have been very active on the Incidental Economist. I'd love you to kind of go through some of your latest blogs and intersperse them with phone calls
sure.
as well. So anybody can hijack this interview, this conversation, as always with Dr. Carroll, if you'd like. But I want to hit some of the best of the blog, if you will. And I don't know, maybe the easiest one first.
Sure.
That's not so elaborate, but hydration. You wrote about hydration. What's not obvious about hydration, even though I did text you on the day I was extremely hungover last week on the way back from Vegas, and you very dickishly said, drink water.
Actually, I think I said drink less. I meant drink less alcohol.
Oh, yeah, that's what you wrote. You're like, I have a hangover. What should I do? You're like, drink less alcohol.
I
was like, thanks, friend.
I think that's what I said, yeah.
So glad I have access to your cell phone. Really appreciate it, friend.
Don't drink so much was, I think, the best advice I could give you and how to make that kind of situation better.
Okay. Why did you blog about hydration? What's
the
controversy?
This is like one of my pet peeves. In fact, like when we wrote our first paper on medical myths for the British Medical Journal way back then, and it was like almost like the first big chapter that we sold the first book on was the myth that you have to drink 8 glasses of water a day. It's like this is one of those that just won't die. I think probably because so much industry is tied up in convincing you that you're dehydrated and if you don't drink more water, you're going to get sick. Or if you drink so much water, you know, you're going to feel great. You're never going to get ill. You're going to be so healthy. And there's just no science at all behind the idea that we're dehydrated or that we need so much water. And yet people are obsessed with it. And, you know, everybody seems to know you need 8 glasses of water. That probably came from a recommendation from like the Nutrition Council back in the 50s where they wrote sort of this big paper that said, you know, we think the average human needs something like 60-some ounces of water a day. And then there was a comma, but everybody ignores after the comma, and they just ignore when they said how much hydration you need. And what it said was, but you're going to get that in your regular diet. Because, you know, you drink during the day. It doesn't matter what you drink. There's water in coffee. There's water in tea. There's water in juice. There's water in beer, even. I mean, all of those things contain water, and that will hydrate you. At the same time, there's water in food. There's water in fruits. There's water in vegetables. There's water in all kinds of things we eat. So you're getting the hydration you need in just a regular, normal diet. Humans did not die out in huge numbers before we managed to find plastic bottles. Because they were dying of dehydration. Moreover, your body is exquisitely tuned to know when you need to drink. When you're thirsty, you're nowhere near dehydration. I mean, that is just the very edge of your body saying, hey, might be a good idea to get something to drink in the future. True dehydration, like clinical dehydration, is you'd be ill. You'd be like in the hospital, and it looks nothing like what we imagine dehydration to be. You don't need that much water extra. You don't need certainly that to be pure water, but everything is sort of built up around this idea that we need to do it. The reason I wrote the blog post was because there was a study recently published where they looked at I think it was it coffee? I'm actually having trouble remembering, but I think it was coffee versus or caffeinated beverages versus regular beverages to see if those dehydrated you, because part of the myth is also that you got to drink pure water because caffeinated beverages will somehow interfere with your kidneys and urination, and those will actually somehow magically dehydrate you as opposed to giving you the huge amounts of water that are in those beverages. And the study proved, as all previous studies have before, that there's just no truth to that at all. The drinking caffeinated beverages has no effect on how much you're, peeing out versus keeping in, and it has no effect on your hydration.
Coffee is not a diuretic?
No, well, it's like, this is the thing. What is
a diuretic? I just wanted to say that
exactly.
Word.
A diuretic means that it makes you pee a little bit more. And so it is possible that coffee, the caffeine, has some tiny sort of in-the-lab measurable effect on how much you pee. But you could say the same thing, like if I spit once or twice a day, am I going to get dehydrated because I've lost more fluid? No, it means that later you'll be a little thirstier and you'll gain it back. So theoretically, coffee in the very short term or caffeine in the very short term could act as a diuretic, but what would immediately happen is that your body would recognize that, hey, we have slightly less water than we thought we would, shut this thing down, and so you'd wind up pee less. So maybe in the first hour or maybe in the first short time period you would pee a little more, but then your body acts to actually combat that and keep the water that it needs. And that's what they found in the study, was that overall urine amounts and overall like concentration had no significant effects, and it really made no difference in how their
wow.
health.
You are killing people right now with
I'm
both
sure.
of these.
They love their
my
food.
Wife.
I have gotten.
I
no
just
joke.
Invited my wife to come down to the studio.
Oh, no.
She carries around a bottle of water.
Yeah.
And
she's gonna get dehydrated.
And I don't know. That's why I wanted her. She certainly believes that drinking water all day, that she needs it.
Well, this is the only myth I've actually, Rachel and I got death threats over. People sent stuff to the
what?
Office. They actually called the police. Yeah. People are so
about the water?
Passionate. This is the one. They're so passionate about this that like death threats came to the office, and administrative assistants got nervous and had to call the police, and it was more of an intervention.
Were either of them from my wife?
I do not believe so, but they were very strange. Mm. Like they were like cut up. I mean, I'm not joking. It was like they weren't like some. They were sort of half written and half
That's
cut up
weird.
Pieces of paper. It was really strange.
Oh yeah, that was my wife. That was
okay. Could be, but this is the one. People are truly, truly passionate and committed. To this one, almost above all others, in the sense that, like this, we're interfering with something almost sacred when we talk about it.
So what? Yeah, but what about the idea though that it makes you think that you feel better if you drink more water? It's refreshing.
Well, okay, fine. Go
can't
ahead.
Some people need more water than others? Can't some human beings' bodies get
Absolutely.
Dehydrated easier than others? Therefore, they need.
Well, let's back up. So do human beings need more water than others? 100% absolutely. That's why the whole idea that eight
No, do human
some
do some human do some people need more water than other people?
Yeah, an incredibly obese man living in the desert needs a huge amount of water compared to a tiny woman who lives on the top of a mountain in the cold. I mean,
but say my wife and I, who are about the same.
Yeah, very unlikely that you need massive amounts of water that are different. In other words, what do you mean by need? Do you like it? Sure. If you by need you mean like we talk about in the United States, like I need an Xbox One, then yeah, people need different amounts of water. But do you mean as like animals with requirements to be healthy and live a normal and the same length of time? No, not huge amounts because we're all wired very similarly in how most of our bodies work. You
and,
would need massively different amounts of water.
And no evidence of dehydration with moderate daily coffee intake. That is what you're telling us.
No evidence at all that you would wind up having that.
And does God exist while you're at it, you asshole?
Well, but see, that's a faith-based thing, and I cannot prove that one way or the other. I want to prove and disprove the things that science gives us the ability to do so. That is not one of them.
Huh.
Well, I didn't give you the answer you wanted there, did I?
Your favorite nemesis, Jason in D.C., Mr. Free Market Healthcare. Are you ready? I don't know how.
Sure.
I don't know what kind of mood you're in. Hey, Jason, I don't think that's what he was calling in on today, though.
No, I was going to comment about, let's talk about the FDA allowing it to have fluoride in your water. We don't need fluoride in our water at all. Fluoride's toxic.
Okay, well, I'll disagree with you entirely there. I think actually fluoride...
All right, so the multiple Harvard studies that have been coming out we can Google those if we want to. Fluoride is not needed in the water supply.
Hold on. Dr. Carroll, I know for a fact, has done a tremendous amount of research on this issue.
And
I've talked to him.
You're never going to get anywhere by throwing out and saying the Harvard study. I mean, I don't care where the studies come from as long as they're high quality. So just because something appears somewhere, has some name attached to it, means nothing.
University of Phoenix Online.
If they do phenomenal research and it's, you know, and the methods are clear and it's, you know, it's well vetted and everything else is good, then it doesn't matter. But, you know, the studies that almost inevitably keep coming out are not sort of population based, not looking at people, not looking at actual health effects. They're all in a lab or trying to find some molecule or trying to find some, and then they say, hey, because we found this, we think it's possible that extrapolating down the line, way down the line, there might be some kind of negative health effects. Now, over-fluoridation is a problem. If you have too much fluoride, it could over-fluoridate your teeth. That can be an issue. And so it is important not to get too much fluoride. But you get way more by swallowing toothpaste than you're ever going to get in the water. And so that would be probably where we'd want to look first, where it is. Now, and there have been cases where water's been over-fluoridated. But on the whole, you know, putting fluoride in the water has done an enormous amount to improve the health of people's teeth, certainly in the United States. Caries are still the number one chronic disease in childhood. Let me say that again. Cavities are the number one chronic disease in childhood. There's a ton of evidence that shows that putting fluoride in the water has done a significant amount to improve the health of people in the United States with their teeth. It's arguably one of the greatest public health achievements of our time. And I know that you can go out there and you can find a quote-unquote study which will say that you can find a molecule, or they've done studies, or they put, you know, this is the same thing.
So great, why isn't everybody putting it in the water?
Who do you mean by everybody?
Well, I would say other countries and so forth. Why aren't they?
Wait a minute, is that really your metric by how?
No. Well, here, you know, the whole point again is if everything is so great and there is no debate about it, I would assume that most places would probably put this in place. But again, if you're purchasing water, there's no need for you to have fluoride in your, especially if it's in toothpaste and so forth. It's a chemical.
Well, it depends.
Chemical.
So you are correct. But again, once again, you're assuming that like the vast majority of people are doing the right thing with toothpaste, or that we're getting it. And also, you have to remember that for a significant amount of time, we can't use fluoride in little babies because we can't put toothpaste in their mouth and hope they're going to do it. They're still developing teeth. They still even have teeth when they're very young, and it's a problem when they get tons of cavities, and we can't brush their teeth with fluoride because we can't tell them not to swallow it. So
because all those people in Africa who don't have access to fluoride, their teeth are just falling out because they're not getting fluoride, right?
They often are rotted and have cavities. I mean, seriously, once again, are you trying to claim that people in Africa with no access to this kind of stuff have the exact same kind of health that we do?
I
think that they do. I think that there are probably significant differences in the amount of tooth decay and the amount of cavities and how their teeth are health and how long they live and a lot of this stuff that matters. I think it absolutely does make a difference. Will teeth rot out completely in everybody if they don't get fluoridated water? No. Will we improve by a significant amount the teeth health of a population by putting fluoride in? Yes. And so that's where we err.
All right. Well, this will be for another time, but I remember the last time we had this discussion, we had the discussion about choice and so forth, and we were discussing things like if people don't have the ability to shop around for healthcare because when there's an emergency, you don't have a choice of what hospital you go to. And then we find out that only 2% of the entire healthcare budget, 2% is spent on emergency rooms.
I didn't mean emergency like you're in an ambulance. Emergency like you're in the doctor's office and they tell you, you have a heart problem and we need to do a cath and we think it needs to be done in the next week. What are you going to do then?
You can shop around.
No, you live – okay, fine. You are welcome to shop around. The vast majority of people have said they don't want to do that, that they want to listen to the doctor, that they don't feel like that they have the necessary capacity to do that, that the hospitals don't have the data available, which we've already discussed why that's so. And so that doesn't happen. In the same way, just because you're not in an emergency room doesn't mean you're not in an ICU. You could be born as a baby and have to go to a NICU. You will do zero shopping around. You could be elderly and you could be, you know, slowly decompensating and need to go to an ICU. You will do zero shopping around. You could need emergent surgery where you don't need to go to an ER, where you just know that, like, you need a gallbladder move or something else and it needs to be scheduled in the next few days. That will not be scheduled in an ER. The stuff that's done in the ER is cheap. It's the stuff that's done once you get past the ER into the hospital
that's incredibly expensive. So I'm not talking about shopping for an emergency room. I'm talking about shopping for all the care that happens afterwards. And that is a massive amount of our budget and takes up far more than 2%.
As always, Jason, appreciate the calls, appreciate the challenges, and I love I'm with Aaron, obviously, in both those answers, especially and clearly the fluoride one. But I dropped him to get to some other calls, Aaron, but that is a really pervasive myth. My wife was on board with that for a minute, and it was like a very difficult argument. I was like, I'm not even going to talk about this anymore. The fluoride one, that's a big conspiracy about the fluoride.
Well, everything's a conspiracy. Vaccines will give you autism, and it's a conspiracy. It's the mercury in the vaccines. That's a conspiracy. It's the fluoride in the water. It's a conspiracy. Everything that sort of winds up being pervasive and sort of mandated and
cancer. Universal. There's a cure for cancer, but they're hiding it.
These are things. But at some point, you gotta sort of. It's the idea too. I mean, I'll pull out cell phones to give you cancer. And we're trying to suppress that too. And at some point, you have to look at. It's possible to do a study on rats in a lab and find something that maybe looks abnormal and try to extrapolate that out to what it might mean for humans. And, maybe we look at the rats for like 10 days, but what happens to humans over a lifetime? But then you have to weigh that against what you see with your own eyes with epidemiologic data in the real world. We have billions of people using these devices every single day, and cancer rates are not skyrocketing through the roof. And in fact, the cancer rates they can sometimes find bear no resemblance, have no kind of correlation to the increase in use in cell phones. You could go back to when we talked about aspartame and other artificial sweeteners in cancer, and everybody said, look, they're causing cancer because if I dump 10 billion pounds of it on a rat, they die. But what we find in the real world is that, they tried to show that brain cancer was increasing, and at the same time they introduced, some of these artificial sweeteners, and they said, look, one's causing the other. But when they really look at the data, it turns out that, first of all, almost all of the increase was in the elderly, who are not the major consumers of Diet Coke, and the increase in cancer started well before the introduction of any of the artificial sweeteners. So it's completely unrelated. And when they do randomized controlled trials, they can't see these health differences.
You are a corporate shill, sir. In New Jersey.
I don't think when I say don't drink too much water, it makes me a corporate shill. But
because you are shilling for the big the anti-water.
Is that a big lobby? I think that the water companies are.
You don't know because you live in Indiana.
Okay, Coke makes all the all those water bottles you buy that have the funky hippie-sounding names are all made by, the big soda companies.
The conspiracy is that one of those water companies poured the chemical in the Elk River in West Virginia.
Really? I didn't hear that one.
Yeah, because I just started it.
Oh.
Mario in New Jersey, you're on Stand Up with Dr. Aaron Carroll. At Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter, everybody. Buy his books, read his blog, watch his videos. He's everywhere. He's the king of all media. Go ahead, Mario.
Hi, guys. Dr. Carroll, I have two questions, one at a time or both at first?
One at a time.
Hey, quickly, what was your question yesterday to me? You direct messaged me about delay online listening to SiriusXM?
Yeah, why is there like a 10-minute delay between what I'm listening to now and what would be on my app?
I know.
Go ahead,
Chris.
To create a buffer.
10 minutes?
But why is it, if I'm driving to the gym and I'm listening to Pete on the radio, when I get to the gym, I got to suffer through almost the same, 5 minutes again before I can actually get to something new.
Suffer?
That is very annoying.
Suffer?
Yeah, why do they need minutes-long buffer? Why can't it be a few seconds? I don't understand.
Find out, Pete.
But I don't know the answer to that, but just to be clear, that's
you
not
work for
new.
That company, right?
Yeah, no, I will find out. I can find out.
For a long time.
No, but it's not I just wanted to make sure that wasn't something that was you just started to happen. I mean, that's every.
This has been going on for years.
That's every channel. When listening to the app, there's a delay.
Okay. Do you know if it's the same in the car?
No, the car
is. What you're hearing in your car is about 40 seconds behind what we're saying here.
No, it's not. Yeah. No, it's not.
That's the time it takes to go to the satellite and come back down to your radio.
I don't think so. We could test that right now.
Yeah, we can. I can listen to what you're saying right now 30 seconds from now.
I thought it was a 7. Why do we have a 7-second delay, though?
No, but it's more than seven seconds, because sometimes sometimes I'll hang up, I'll get off the phone with you, hang up, and then I'll like turn on the radio and I'll actually hear myself still. So it's
I thought it was under 10 seconds.
No.
We have that too.
Okay, let's get back to health, guys.
Go ahead. Thank you, Mario.
This is fascinating.
So,
drink more Gatorade.
So, two questions, one at a time. First one, are you concerned with insurers and hospitals, and vice versa, buying up each other? How it could possibly, they could possibly manipulate the medical loss ratio?
Okay, so so I'm going to say yes and not as much. Like, I am concerned.
Well, hold on there, Brain. What's the medical loss ratio?
Okay, fine. The medical loss ratio. So when a health insurance company collects money from you, they spend a certain amount of it on your actual health care, and then they spend a percentage of it on other stuff. Some of it is like administration. Some of it is the rent on their building. Some of it is dividends. Some of it is profit. Some of it is executive bonuses. So, you know, a percentage of what you pay in your premiums goes to health versus other stuff. One of the things the Affordable Care Act did was to try to limit the amount that insurance companies could spend on other stuff. So they said 85% of the money that they collect in premiums has to go to actual health care, and they can take the 15%, that's the rest of it, and do whatever they want. Now, they can also spend more on health care, but they couldn't spend less. Now, this is fine for a lot of health care companies or health insurance companies that have always operated like this. You know, an efficient company that was, you know, spending much less on overhead is going to do great. A company that was very inefficient and was sort of bilking you is in trouble. But that's still the new law, 85% they have to spend on actual health. What the caller was asking was, am I concerned about hospitals and insurance companies sort of merging and getting together in the sense that they could manipulate, you know, sort of change how much they're spending on health and try to fudge the lines so that they could actually, you know, spend, you know, keep more in profits in various ways by, you know, if they were keeping the money in profit on the healthcare side, then they don't need as much to keep on the administration side, and that'll work. Now, that's a concern. And I think that, like, probably people need to keep an eye on that, but I believe that that can somewhat be overcome by regulation. What I'm much more concerned about is that consolidation can lead in many ways to higher prices. When hospitals merge and form big systems, they have a huge market share, and that gives them a lot of negotiating power when they go to the table with insurance companies to say, hey, we own all the hospitals in town. If you want your patients in this big city to actually get care, you're just going to have to pay our rates, and there's nothing you can do about it. So there are times when merging at certain healthcare levels leads to significantly increased healthcare spending. That I'm super concerned about, of course, because you know, we're trying to get a handle on healthcare spending. Conversely, however, when insurance companies merge, there's often a decrease in healthcare spending because they have more negotiating power. They can say to hospitals, hey, you know, we control like 80% of the patients that live in this area. If you want to see any of them, you're going to drop your rates, and that will often decrease healthcare spending. What we're talking about here, though, is not insurance company consolidation. It's consolidation of sort of insurance companies with the healthcare side. I'm not sure which way it's going to go, but theoretically it could go towards higher spending. That concerns me greatly.
So that was the second question. You actually got into the second question I was going to ask you about the consolidation of the hospitals and providers. So on one hand, we have the pricing power that you talked about, but the other hand, we have the increased coordination in care, which is something that the ACA is trying to look for.
Go ahead. Sorry, go.
Since you answered that, I'll go on to the – do you know anything about the payment system between the government when they're paying subsidies on a monthly basis to the insurer and the how do they track that? I mean, so if I'm paying for 3 months and then I stop paying, does the government keep paying? How do they reconcile between the
two?
What do
you mean government paying? You mean the subsidies for insurance and the exchanges?
Yeah, so if you're eligible for a credit, right, you can either take it once at the end of the year or you can get it
paid now. It comes to you. It does not go
to the insurance. No, it goes directly to the insurance company.
The insurance, the credit?
The part of the
I don't think
the
it goes. Well, that's absolutely a very interesting question. No, it's an advanceable tax credit. You're right. So you can just claim it at the end of the year if you wanted. I mean,
no,
so
I understand that, but most people are going to take a lower premium right now, right? So
yeah, they're going to have to. You know what? To be honest with you, I bet they're still trying to figure that stuff out now.
Oh, I can't believe I stumped you.
Well, this is why, because I think, you know, these are the kinds of unintended consequences that they, I don't think that they, I don't believe they thought through clearly enough. For instance, insurance companies, when they look at it right now, they are finding that, you know, a decent number of people, they might have paid the first month, they might have paid the second month, they're not paying the third month. And so now the big question is, well, what are they going to do? Are they going to drop people's policies? And I think at the moment, the insurance companies are being pretty generous because, of course, as long as they keep the policies going, they will keep getting their government subsidy. But how long they will do that until they decide to drop the coverage, I don't know. And I bet that that's up to the insurance company. And so I'm sure they're running calculations every day of whether it's in their best interest to try to keep it going and collect the money later or to drop it and lose the subsidy that they were getting. So I would – my guess is that they – it's up to the discretion of the insurance company when they want to cancel a policy for when somebody's not paying their bill. But, you know, as long as people are not seeking that much health care and they can still get the subsidy by claiming they, you know, are, you know, willing to waive the rest of the payment, they will. So I don't know how that's going to play out. I don't.
Wow. I just love listening.
Now, do you think that Larry Leavitt and Kaiser's assertion that only getting 25% of 18 to 34 age pool will only increase the premiums 2 to 3%? Have you done any?
I think the Kaiser Family Foundation is about as trustworthy as you get when it comes to health care. I think that you'll find that people on both sides of the aisle have very little negative things to say about them. They do a fairly good job of trying to remain non-partisan, even though people will say that they are, but at least to be very rigorous and open about their methods. They're not using, you know, sort of hidden data. They're working often with the insurance companies who are providing them data because they do this kind of sort of rigorous, trustworthy work. I think that, you know, the difference, you have to remember that everybody's concerned about young, healthy. What truly matters is not, I mean, sorry, young, old.
Age, right.
Not young, old. It's healthy, non-healthy.
Right.
And so we have shorthanded that into young and old, but really it comes down to healthy, unhealthy. And so it is
We won't know until they start actually putting in
claims. Is absolutely correct. But, you know, with the risk corridors are going to suck up a decent amount of the uncertainty. You know, we will see premium increases or not. But, you know, the fact that they have this many young people in already, because of the ways that we know, you know, just from past history, how people tend to sign up insurance, the young people tend to be the last. They tend to wait till the last second. So what they're seeing so far is not what they'd hope to see in an ideal world, but it looks like it has achieved a level which would result in an absorbable increase in premiums and a reasonably stable, if not quite stable, market going out into the future. They will have to continually update that analysis, which I also trust that Larry and the Kaiser Family Foundation will do. And if those change and if the numbers change and analysis change, I'm sure they'll tell us why, and then we can discuss it then. But, you know, they do not have an agenda in the sense that they're trying to spin the numbers to make the Affordable Care Act look good. They have too precious a reputation, and they care far too much about, you know, what they're doing and trying to improve the healthcare system and the role that they serve, I think, to try to fudge the numbers in any way.
All right, the Mario and Dr. Carroll Show. Mario, always great when you call and tweet, everybody. Everybody loves listener, one of our favorites, Mario, is Jerry _ Mario, one of our all-stars. Should I do this to you? There's another fluoride question.
I mean, if you want. I mean, if that's where you want to go today, feel free. Go ahead.
Well, it's not as important as Mark's question. So hold on, Tom. Aaron will answer your question about fluoride. But Mark was waiting longer and has, a more legitimate question, perhaps. Sorry, Tom. Hold on if you want to. Mark in North Carolina. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. First of all, Doctor, and the show's really great. First time listening. And I really appreciate you doing – I love smart people. I'm not one of them, but I love smart people because they accelerate my knowing. It's very trustworthy. But I have one question. Hopefully you can factually navigate this for me.
Sure.
When people talk about this fluoride and this a lot of these scares, mercury, I have three kids, newly born over the last 5 years, and – you know, there's a lot of this, you know, Dr. Sears, and you try to read as much as possible because that's what we were taught to do, and you try to get as educated as you can on your own because of the mistrust of not only government but other institutions.
Sure.
And then you speak, and when I what I thank you for is your assertiveness, and it sounds like so far, without checking into it, that you're trying to base it on fact and at least your view of the world. I think a fear that is for real, and hopefully you can change this on me, is people used to smoke during pregnancy, and that has been proven in that it is not a healthy thing to do for a child or for the mother. And what me is, and my wife is new parents, and without all the facts, and the internet is sometimes overwhelming, of course, and who to believe, fluoride doesn't sound so good in the narrative.
I didn't realize this guy was a fluoride question as well.
No, it's not a fluoride question. The doctor speaks in not always indefinite, but in a definite tone. And I feel like if he was in 1950, would he be saying the same? And how do I reconcile that in your opinion?
If you said to me, is smoking healthy or unhealthy in the 1950s, first of all, there was a ton of evidence that said smoking was unhealthy. It was just that it was very hard to get to it. How do you know that, you know, that there is a research study in 1950 that said something about it? Unless you had a subscription to the medical journal in which it was published, and unless the New York Times had that day decided to put it on the front page, it was very, very unlikely you were ever going to see it. There was no internet. There was no Stand Up with Pete Dominic. You know, the ability to sort of move that information around is very difficult. The incredible increase in our ability to sort of put medical data together and do analyses is a reasonably recent thing. You know, I will sometimes talk about randomized controlled trials and things like that. I think people will be shocked to know that, you know, we're only talking like decades that we've actually been doing randomized controlled trials. This is not something that like Isaac Newton invented. And so our ability to do causal studies is much more sophisticated than it was in the 1950s. Again, having said that, even if I had perfect knowledge in the 1950s, we didn't know. And so my answer then would be, you know what? We just don't know because we haven't done enough controlled trials to see what's going to happen. That's not true with fluoride. You know, fluoride.
I wasn't talking specifically about fluoride, but yes, I understand that. That is a clear answer.
But the other thing that's really interesting about our guest, Mark, since it's your first time listening, is not only is he an MD, but he's a health policy researcher, and it sounds pretty boring, and it is. He's very boring. What he does is very complex in terms of the research. So he does research all day. And one of the things, and I shouldn't be speaking for him, he'll punch this up here, but is he researches research. So he takes all the research on a given issue, all of the studies on a given issue, and charts them out. And many, many very smart people, respected economists, health policy research, reference our guest works. So we're very lucky to have him, but explain what advances we've made in the ability to do that type of research of research, and how much of that you end up doing all day. To be fair, while he's doing that, I'm told he's binge watching quite a few terrible, terrible television shows.
Totally am. Absolutely. No, that's I'm not actually joking. I am. But I mean, this is the kind of, like, look, there's in our first book, I think there's a 4 or 5, you know, page chapter on fluoride. And I mean, I haven't wasted a ton of time here, but if callers are truly interested, we can go through the studies. I mean, I can start rattling them off about, you know, the research that has been done and, you know, the systematic reviews of hundreds of trials in 20 to 25 countries that have, you know, proven conclusively that fluoride, you know, improves teeth health. This isn't like, you know, we don't know, we didn't do the study, and maybe I'm guessing, and I'm being paid off by the fluoride industry. You know, there's no conflict of interest here. I'm not working for anyone, certainly not making any money from big fluoride, and I'm not even sure what big fluoride putting it in the water would be. But there's.
Again, I didn't mean to do fluoride. I apologize. I mean, it could be, you know, if the internet is new, and cell phones are somewhat new, especially, you know, holding into your ear feel warm. You know, these things I equate in a not critical thinking way. And I'm just trying, and I can't thank you enough for the water.
You know,
this
I appreciate
great.
It.
And I appreciate
the, you gotta get
much.
His Mark, if you like this stuff, honestly, get his books.
Oh, absolutely.
He's written two
absolutely.
Books and he's working on a third that debunks all these things. And Aaron, speak to the idea that of the anecdote. Aaron taught me a lot about the anecdote, but you know, it's the experience that you have. And so much of it is counterintuitive. Well, the phone is heating up.
that can't be good for my brain.
Right.
And that's all I know, but it seems like that wouldn't be good for my brain. The anecdote, the experience that you have or a story that you hear impresses upon you a belief that you consider, whether it be about, you know, race or fluoride, that you consider truth.
Let's take video games and violence, for instance. You know, we will see someone do something horrific, and the TV will tell us that that person played violent video games. Ipso facto, violent video games are associated, if not causing, violence. But that is an anecdote. That is one story of two things that happen to be true. What it ignores is that gazillions of people play violent video games. They are so enormously popular, it is hard to find probably a male between 15 and 25 who doesn't play violent video games. And yet the number of violent people is actually going down significantly in the United States. Homicide rates are at an all-time low almost in the United States, at least back to like the 50s or 60s. You know, murder rates, assault rates, rape rates, all of the rates you can find for crime are, and I just did a video of this a couple of weeks ago, are almost at an all-time low from like the 60s or 70s. I mean, way less than they used to. And yet violent video games are ubiquitous. Moreover, violent video games are played all over the world. And yet, really, when we talk about these increases in horrible, violence acts, they seem to be concentrated in the United States. We can debate why that is, but it, you know, it doesn't follow. In no other country do we sort of see this kind of correlation, or people even supposing that it is, that violent video games are somehow the thing. But just because we hear the story and it makes intuitive sense to us, you know, that is enough to sort of make us believe that some kind of scientific or causal link is there. But
there's been an epidemic
and data to actually look at whether these things really truly are related or not.
You got to go see that video. It's probably my favorite because it uses statistics to chart how good things are in the world. And you know, pointing out that, you know, Mark, you're a new father. I think you said, and we're so worried about our kids. They're going to be kidnapped. They're going to be tortured. They're going to be raped. The truth is,
drugs. They're going to do alcohol. They're going to all of these things. Teen birth rates are at an all-time low. Teen abortion rates are at an all-time low. Teen pregnancy rates are not. Everything's awesome.
But here's what's different. Here's what's different. And maybe I don't know if you'll agree or disagree with me this, Aaron. I don't know if you. I think you included this. And what's at an all-time high is our exposure to those stories.
That I got to believe that that's true. I'm not sure that there's data, but I don't know how that couldn't be true. I mean, we're just...
So when we hear a plane crash, we hear of every plane crash.
Right.
We hear of every one of them. So it seems like more planes are crashing. The difference is we didn't always hear about them. We hear of every kidnapping. We didn't always hear about them. We hear of every murder. We didn't... shooting. We didn't always hear about
shooting.
All of
them. Well, actually, I would actually disagree with that. I think we have a pretty bad skew of which kidnappings and murders we hear about, but that's a topic for another day.
Well, when they're white versus black, for sure. Mark,
can I say one thing for you, please?
Yeah, go ahead, quickly.
I can't thank you enough for being smart. I know that sounds weird.
well, you're too kind.
I appreciate it, and I will buy your books, and keep up the good work for us regularly.
Will you follow him on Twitter? Will you follow him on Twitter?
I absolutely will. If you'll just say it one more time, I'm ready.
It is at Pete Dominic is his Twitter handle.
No.
Right. Thanks,
it's guys. At Aaron E. Carroll. Two R's, two L's, at Aaron E. Carroll. Mark, thank you very much for the call, your generous comments, and welcome to the broadcast. Stand up. Important issues, expert guests every day, hosted by a comedian, me, who is not important and not expert on anything. And we're all welcome to ask questions to everybody that's on 866-994-6343. Aaron, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, though, we're going to talk about MTV and sex, polio vaccines in India,
sure.
Single payer. You've got a very controversial blog about that at The Incidental Economist. And anything that you want, you can hijack my agenda right now. 866-994-6343. Is the phone number, and am I playing with fire that I haven't gotten my second test back on my vasectomy, but I have been taking risks? Isn't the first test good enough?
I would err on getting both.
Okay, we'll be right back after these words.
America's Next Top Model. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
Play it faster. Welcome back. Dr. Aaron Carroll joins us for this final half hour or so segment of Stand Up. He's a health policy expert. He is a YouTube star now, host of Healthcare Triage. He debunks myths about your body and your health. He tweets at Pete Dominic. He tweets at Aaron E. Carroll, Aaron E. Carroll, two R's, two L's, and he writes a blog. He contributes to a really great blog, The Incidental Economist. And let's quickly get to Bob in Wisconsin, who wanted to ask or mention something about video games and violence that you just used as an example. Go ahead, Bob. There's no correlation, is what you said before the break, yes. Basically. Bob, go ahead.
Right. Pete, as always, lousy show. Please find another job. Hey, listen, ironically, my son and I, he's 15 years old, and he loves to play video games. And we were actually having this discussion just a few days ago. And I'm a retired critical care healthcare worker. And the first patient I ever had in a head trauma unit was a little boy who was playing with his cousins out in the backyard, and one of his little cousins picked up a log and smashed him in the head, giving him a very severe TBI. And this was because they were playing, and it was a Ninja Turtle. That's what was going on. Now, I know this isn't across the board, but
not unlike the time hit a gorilla with a hammer after playing Donkey Kong.
I'm going to tell you another story, which is entirely true, and you could call my mother and ask. When I was about 4 and a half, I was standing on a kitchen chair near the fridge, and I thought, like Superman, if I jumped hard enough, I could fly and make it to the kitchen table. And I didn't. And I fell back, and I hit my head, and I cut it open, and blood was everywhere, and I needed to be rushed to the emergency room and get stitches, and I still have a nice scar in the back of my head. Is that Superman's fault? And should we blame
Hold on. While we're at it, Chris, tell everybody what happened to you after playing Frogger when you were 8.
Made it successfully across the I-5 in California.
I've got another one, if I may, just really quick. And this is something else I brought up.
But why? But wait, hold on. Telling us anecdotes? Why are you telling us these stories? What's the point?
Think that because we saw something or because someone did something that therefore, like, we should ban it or that we should be concerned about it, it's like, well, then fairy tales are horrifically, violent at times. You know, every Disney movie involves a parent being murdered if you go back in the day. This kind of stuff has always existed. Always.
Right. I love to play devil's advocate, and that's with somebody like you, because I see and I'm educated and I understand this, but then I also I love to hear the other side on an educated level because
there aren't two sides always of evidence. That's what I'm saying. And combating, anecdotes is hard because they impact us and they influence all of us, even the good doctor, I'm sure. Making decisions for himself and for his kids based on something he might have heard or experienced in terms of what neighborhood he might go in or what store he might visit and so on. Yep. But what matters more than anything when we make choices in life for ourselves or our kids, I think, my opinion, is the evidence that we have for it. And people can cherry pick evidence, but Aaron, pick up where I'm leaving off.
Well, again, this is the same thing I think I said before. It's like, this is why it's important not to just go by what we see and what we hear, but to try to collect enough data that we can do an analysis and use sophisticated techniques to figure out, okay, that Ninja Turtle story resulted in a head injury, but are head injuries statistically significantly more common in Ninja Turtle watchers versus not? Or does it turn out that, the kids that aren't watching Ninja Turtle are playing cowboys and Indians and hurting each other? Or are playing, space aliens and, monsters and hurting each other? Or playing just soldiers and hurting each other? Does Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles lead to a significantly large increase in the number of types of injuries that we see? My boys watched The Karate Kid, and then, for a week I had to chase them around the house because every time I did, they were trying to crane kick each other in the face. Mm-hmm. Boys do this. Girls
After I watched Karate Kid, I searched for an old Japanese mentor for months and found nothing. And I should also mention, and I don't think this is a correlation, but after playing Galaga, I was abducted by an alien spacecraft. But I don't think that those two are correlated, I think that's just a coincidence. And I've got seven more jokes if you want them. But
Well, and your painting skills have definitely improved. On the mass shooting situation, on the mass shooting situation, which this was really a great part of my son and I, our conversation. And I was just wondering, and we talked about correlation. And, okay, first of all, there are a million game players out there, and they are statistically, ratio-wise, there are a very small amount of mass shootings relative to game players. But I find it interesting that a lot of these mass shooters that go into these confined spaces, theaters, schools, whatnot, malls, and they have bags, backpacks full of weapons. Right. Ironically, when you play video games, you run around and you collect weapons laying on the ground or earn points, and you have a backpack full of weapons. You go to these mass shootings and you do your research after they've occurred, and you notice that they rarely, I would dare say, I haven't investigated all of these different events, but they've got these bags full of weapons and bullets, but they've only really used one weapon and gone through maybe a few clips before they shoot themselves or are shot before the event ends. They don't get into this big cache that they've collected like you do on a
What's
video
the
game.
Point? What's the, you're losing me, Bob, quickly.
Okay. So what I'm
Is it about duffel
about
bag purchases?
I'm talking about the emulation of the game of these
I got it.
Am I making sense? Am I?
You're trying, but I just want to say asked and answered. Asked
no,
and answered.
I just want to say, like, I think the larger problem here is how did they get their hands on a huge cache of weapons?
Oh, Lord, yes. Right. Yes. So totally agree.
And more importantly, Bob, I'm going to let you go, but more importantly on the gun debate, again, Aaron taught me this. Also, Adam Winkler at UCLA has spoken to this, and anybody who studies gun violence and the issue, as hard as it may be for people to believe, is not mass shootings in America. The gun violence is overwhelmingly related to crime and suicides, far more than mass violence. So we shouldn't be trying to necessarily address the mass shooting incidents as we should gun violence in general. Right? Make that smarter.
But I mean, well, it's also, first of all, that I want to absolutely endorse what you just said. It's like, you know, the vast majority of injuries and deaths from guns are not in mass shootings. They're just in everyday things. But we only sort of get riled up and sort of focused on it when it's something that's, and we even say a mass shooting. But often those result in, you know, a handful of deaths versus that can happen in any city on any night. And yet we don't focus on that as much. But I'd also like to say that, you know, again, we're focusing on this. I play games or I watch things with superpowers, and yet, you know, we don't see kids get super. Well, that's because superpowers aren't available. You know, they don't get superpowers and go out and then hurt others.
Again, I have to defer to Chris and Alfred on that.
Okay. Guns are available. So guns are what we hear about. They're not going to. They're looking for. These are deranged individuals who want to do something specific, and they use the tools that are available to allow them to do that. To try to blame it on, you know, a violent video game or something like that. Well, then we would need to see some sort of evidence that shows that when people watch more violent video or play more violent video games, they do this more. So you need a controlled trial. You have to find people who do watch, or you need to look at different populations where they watch it. And the one thing that sort of correlates to, you know, the ability to do these mass shootings is the United States. That's the correlation. It is not the video games. It's that they happen most often in the United States. There's something about the United States, not the video games.
Can you do sex in MTV and polio in India in under 4 minutes?
Well, polio in India is almost like 2 seconds. Yes, absolutely. Okay. They eradicated polio in India. It's a mind-boggling achievement. There's been like no cases for 3 years. It's attributed almost entirely to the vaccination. But India for a long time was a country that the WHO had thought they were never going to get success. It had so many problems with poverty and trying to get the stuff out to the right areas that I think people despaired that it would never succeed and that this would be one of those countries that would be left to last. And they're basically declaring victory. It's a major public health achievement.
About their next door neighbor, however, because Pakistan has an issue with it, and isn't that issue that they have that they are very, very generalizing here, but I've heard this a number of times about Pakistan is the when polled, Pakistanis' beliefs in conspiracy theories about the U.S., much less maybe a vaccine, And it's not the autism conspiracy, perhaps, but
it's very hard. It's often infrastructure. We take for granted sometimes about just the fact that we have such awesome roads that allow everyone in America.
Malaria in Africa.
Yeah, malaria. You know, there's so many diseases we just don't see here, and we can bitch about the fluoride, but our public health infrastructure is strong enough that there are tons of diseases that we just don't even worry about. I mean, diarrhea kills untold number of people in the world every year, and we consider diarrhea for the most part to be an inconvenience.
I got to apologize. Only 13 new followers for you today on Twitter. I'm very let down. But yeah, we still have a replay. @AaronE. Carroll is his Twitter handle. Okay, quickly, MTV and sex.
Yeah. So there was a little study that was just published recently, which looked at like those MTV shows, like Teen Pregnant Mom. I don't even know what they're called. And I wrote a piece on how I usually despise these kinds of shows because I think that they just seem to glorify situations where and make it look like it's easy to do some things when it's really not. One being a teenager and having a child. So my inclination was to believe that like these kinds of shows probably increase teen pregnancy and lead to a lot of sort of outcomes that we wouldn't want. But the study was interesting and well done, and it basically showed that whenever kids were watching it, when ratings went up in certain areas, they actually wound up talking and tweeting and texting about things like birth control and pregnancy avoidance more. And in areas of the country where ratings are higher, it looks like teen birth rates were down an extra 5.5% or 5.7%, I think, above what they would have expected.
It really surprised me that you blogged about that, because not having looked at any of it, not even if I had known, knowing what to do with that information, it really doesn't seem like you can measure tweets, and it really doesn't seem like necessary correlation between high ratings in an area and causing lower pregnancy rates necessarily.
Well, this is when I wish we had more time, because you're right. I'm never going to prove that it's causal because it's not a randomized controlled trial, but they can be reasonably sophisticated in taking advantage of geographic variation, of areas which are similar to each other in many ways, but have a difference only in the percentage of people that watch it by Nielsen ratings. They can actually look at Google searches. Google does have that ability to sort of aggregate that kind of stuff, and Twitter allows for it as well. They can look at trends and things like that, and it turns out that overall people talk about birth control and avoiding pregnancy significantly more when the show is on than when it is not. And they can show that in areas of the country that are similar but one has a higher Nielsen rating, pregnancy rates have dropped more. What's moreover, it's not abortion rates haven't dropped, it's just the pregnancy rates, which means that this is actually looks like it's pregnancy prevention and not the idea that teens are actually going out and getting more abortions. Is it absolutely, utterly conclusive? No. But, it is, since we're not going to have sometimes randomized controlled trials, you got to go with the best stuff that you have. And I'm willing to admit my preconceived notions are perhaps wrong here, and that the show, might actually convince some teens not to have sex or get pregnant. So, fine. I'm still not going to watch it, but I think I said
it. You're watching it right now. I'm binge watching it. Lies.
Who do.
@AaronE. Carroll, 14 new followers, but the replay will change that. Come on, double it. @AaronE. Carroll, think for yourself. Thank you, Aaron. Be the change that you want to see. @AlfredSchultz, @MelanieStarling, @MovingSideways. Give all of them followers, too, because I don't know. Did that make any sense? Give them followers? I stink. All right, 16 new for Aaron Carroll. Talk to you tomorrow.